Great. Thank you so much, CJ, for the presentation on the three countries, Kenya, Malawi, and South Africa. First, I'd like to draw everyone's attention to some of the links in the box on the left of your screen, the first of which is Value Added Food Month on AgriLinks. This webinar is part of a suite of blogs, postings on various topics, all related to value-added foods. And what we mean by value-added foods, that includes crops or foods that have been enhanced through various improvements, including processing, fortification, increased safety, nutrition, or better packaging for extended storage. And the benefits include providing better nutrition, particularly to children and mothers, greater income for producers, for the farmers or small-scale processors and traders involved in that supply chain, as well as access to new markets, as well as new processes to improve packaging and storage, reducing waste to ensure greater food safety. One of the really interesting innovations that I think CJ brought up during the presentation is new advancements in cold storage and especially in chilled transport that could potentially be making major gains in terms of reducing costs in terms of getting processed or fresh foodstuffs from African markets to the international market. So wanted to draw your attention there. We've had a very robust chat window during this webinar, so thanks very much for everyone who's participated. Keep your questions coming, and we'll have some time right now to address those questions, Caroline and CJ live, and of course, Tawanda, as he's been doing in the chat box. Thank you so much, Tawanda. So I'll go ahead and kick off with a question generally. So thank you very much, Caroline and CJ. I wanted to ask, this methodology, we've really gone in deep talking about orange flush sweet potato, but more broadly, how is this methodology on commercial opportunities? How do you see it applied generally as development professionals look to scale technologies and particular crops and food systems?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Aviva. And one of the reasons why we took somewhat longer to explain to you how we were thinking about this and why we looked at certain parts of the potential set of applications and not others was to actually illustrate this methodology. This approach is very suitable to be applied to other products, other crops. In fact, we have already applied variations of this in a few different settings, most of it with ISP as well, and been able to either unlock some significant investment, particularly in the edible oil sector in Tanzania, that had been in a bit of a gridlock until we took much more of a demand and investor approach and were able to identify what truly stood in the way and help overcome that and bring an investor in. Or in some other cases, being able to actually help dispel the myth or burst the bubble of something that just isn't ready for private sector investment and then doesn't warrant a continued donor or government engagement in trying to drag the private sector along when they're not ready to move forward. So I think this methodology really helps you to identify where are those sweet spots where there is a need to unlock something or to bring some partners together, where are areas that actually are about to kick off already move out of their own accord and just meet you applauding by the sidelines and stepping in as and when some help is needed, and where there are areas that fundamentally are not yet or may never be viable opportunities for private sector investment.
Great, thank you. And that also helps us as development professionals prioritize and understand where public sector dollars can be invested and where private sector dollars can be facilitated or catalyzed or not. So it really that methodology really helps us in terms of knowing what elements we should be supporting in various crops and technologies. Okay, wonderful. Now we'll turn to some of the questions from the chat box now. Looking at the question from Maiwish Maradia asks, did the study authors look into consumer preferences unwillingness to pay or purchase for orange flesh sweet potato-based processed products. For example, the bread example that we went into in Kenya. So I'll turn that question over to Carlin.
A little bit. It wasn't the core focus of our work, and we predominantly tried to answer that question through understanding what the processors and the producers of these products felt about it, because ultimately what matters when they're about to make a decision whether or not to put a product on the market is what they believe about the consumer preferences. We did actually look at the bread in Kenya, which was already in on the market in Tusky's supermarket. There was we actually sent out researchers a couple of days to just simply count the number of loaves on the shelves in a number of Tusky supermarkets at different times of the day to confirm that, A, the product was available, and, B, it was actually being sold. So we had people go in morning, afternoon, and evening to count the number of loaves, and with that were able to confirm what Tusky's had been sharing as their sort of sales volume. The reason we did that and the reason we didn't just take Tusky's word for it was related to a dynamic that CJ already described around the bun cutter in Malawi. There is a reality where private sector actors are not oblivious of the fact that development agencies want them to come to the table and are keen to have development support and know that there's money on the table for that. So they do sometimes have an incentive to play things up a little and make an opportunity look somewhat bigger so that they get more support in making it real. So with that in mind, we didn't just take Tusky's word for it, and we actually went and checked and confirmed that the order of magnitude estimate that they gave around their sales was correct. We did not go out and research and ask individual consumers, because what we wanted to look at was proven buying behavior rather than stated preferences. If you go out and ask people and have them taste products or ask them about products they have, there is a whole deep body of research that says there isn't the biggest link between what people state they want to buy and what they actually buy. You see that a lot in sort of, you know, fair trade products, when people say what's the premium they're willing to buy for those products, and then you look at actual buying behavior and they're accepting a much lower premium. So stated preferences is not the best predictor of actual buying behavior, so we stayed as close to actual buying behavior as we possibly could.
Great. Thank you, Carline. Looking at another question coming in on Nigeria. So it's true, this study focused on three countries, and it was no accident. We did intentionally choose countries of various size, market size, in different states of economic development, in order just to broadly define some topologies for where there may or may not be opportunities for large-scale commercialization of orange flesh sweet potato. So a question came in on Nigeria, and though we didn't study it deeply, perhaps we could say some sort of broad thing about potential in Nigeria, or what one would have to look at if they wanted to start studying the viability of commercial investment in Nigeria.
Yeah. So we've taken a approach that's not that different from what we did in the other countries, where you look at income segmentation and consumption of processed products with a particular focus on bread, again, as the sort of entry product and the biggest product, to see what that bread consumption is and to see sort of how that market is evolving, and then compare that to the current growing profile. What we did consistently in each of the countries, and we didn't focus that much on it today because it wasn't the focus of the presentation, but we did make sure that growing OFSP for farmers made sense. So you look at the farm gate price and their yield and what it will result in terms of income for them for a particular plot size to make sure that this is better than something else they could be doing. So you would always do that analysis so that you don't actually trick farmers into doing something that is actually a deterioration of their livelihood from an economic perspective. So you would do that size, and then the market sizing, particularly for domestic consumption for bread, and how that evolves. And then the subsequent step, if you see that that leads to potential viable case, then you would be looking at how the cost of wheat in Nigeria, and the availability of wheat has been evolving. So to the analysis that CJ showed for Kenya, to see how that compares to the cost of getting OFSP and processing OFSP into bread, and then the subsequent step would be to engage with the bakers to see what, like whether they're interested, so the baking industry, whether they're interested. And that is very linked also to the structure of that industry. So as CJ mentioned, in South Africa, for example, the baking industry is vertically integrated, so almost all bakeries actually own wheat farms. So that it doesn't, and wheat mills. So it doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense for them to switch over, because what are they going to do with the wheat that they're growing and that they're owning? So that industry sector actually dispels an opportunity a little. So you would have to look at that as well, to really put yourself in the industry, in the baker's shoes in this case, like what is the full-on cost saving and investment that they need to make to start using OFSP.
Great, thank you. We're sitting, Caroline and myself are sitting in Washington, D.C. at USAID headquarters. And CJ is in Kigali, Rwanda. So CJ, just wanted to give an opportunity if you wanted to make any comments on a few of the previous questions as well.
It's always hard to add much thought following someone as sharp as Caroline. I will say to the Nigeria point, you know, knowing what we know about Nigeria, large middle class, large population, I think the study that needs to be run really is a study around structure and cost, as Caroline pointed out. And so I would encourage someone, and maybe that's you, whoever asked the question, to begin to really look at what is the structure of bakeries and processed food, and what are their cost structures and their access to wheat, and what's happening to wheat costs in Nigeria. I think, you know, I would hypothesize that smallholder farmers would benefit from growing OFSP, certainly over growing maize or wheat. And so if I were to choose a range of African countries where I would want to do the study next, Nigeria would be high on the list. So to whomever asked that question, I do hope you continue to pursue it and push it.
Thank you, CJ. Your contributions are very much valued from Kigali. Thank you so much. Looking at more questions and comments that keep coming in through the chat windows, we really appreciate everyone's very active participation. Turning back to Caroline, you had mentioned this methodology being used in Tanzania, and I think you mentioned edible oil. So curiosity about which edible oil, and has the methodology been used for other crops in Tanzania?
Yeah, so we've used a variation of this methodology so far on livestock, horticulture, small-scale irrigation technologies, which obviously not a crop, but a supporting tool, as well as sunflower oil in the edible oils space in Tanzania. And just a few words on that edible oils work. Like for many other countries, edible oils in Tanzania is a very big part of their imports, and therefore a big draw on their forex. It's the second biggest commodity or product that they import in terms of volume and value, whereas the country is actually quite suited to grow oilseeds, but local processing of oil to a refined quality, which is what consumers prefer to buy, hadn't led to price parity with imported refined palm oil. And the main reason for that actually was not, as government and researchers and development actors had been thinking for a long time, because of agronomic shortfalls, low yields, and poor seeds at the farmer level, but it was actually because the step that is required to get enough yield on the refinement for sunflower oil to be price competitive with palm oil is a processing step that requires a very large minimum viable scale. So that requires industrial production, whereas most of the processing of oil was farm-size processing, cooperative level processing, which is a mechanical process and doesn't yield enough oil out of those seeds to actually yield a product that is price competitive with imported palm oil. As an interesting side note, Kenyan traders had actually picked up on this opportunity, and what they did was they bought the oily seed cake, which is a residue once you press sunflower oil, brought it to Kenya, processed it there industrially, and then sold both the oil back to Tanzania as well as the VOE seed cake, which is a really interesting animal feed product. So you take something that is basically waste, an oily seed cake, and you produce it into two very valuable products. Once we had identified that, and we did that with the help of an industrial actor who was at the table from the get-go, what we were able to identify was that there was a very, very healthy business case here for a local FMCG player to set up that industrial-scale processing and to start selling homemade, Tanzania-made sunflower oil, refined sunflower oil, and be able to do so profitably at a price that was at or below the price of imported palm oil. But what it required was a clear-eyed look at what stood in the way, which in this case was the way that processing was structured and it not being at viable enough a scale to justify the use of the technology that was required. Interestingly, that meant in terms of support from donors and from the Tanzanian government, that the TA-type effort and the effort into different seeds and different agronomic practices and increased yield was not necessary for this opportunity to be viable for both the investor and the smallholder farmers. Obviously always helpful to further increase yield and further increase quality, but it was not a stumbling block. And that meant that the government of Tanzania could focus just on its tax policy around the oils, which were necessary to create a bit of a break window in which the oil could come up at price parity.
Great. Thank you, Caroline. I know that the work with the Tanzanian government in that case, working on their tax policy, was really transformative, not just for the oil seed sector, but then largely in terms of investment promotion and being a more attractive market for others to come in with food processing and other investments. In the course of the analysis on OFSB, how did policy play a role, and if so, how so? I know it wasn't the focus this time, but just curious if it came up in discussions with potential investors or processors.
So the place where policy came up was actually in the international trade, and particularly on the requirements that are placed on food products going into, for example, Europe. Which would be the destination market for this food, this shelf-stable puree. That was an interesting opportunity for Kenya. And that product goes into, for example, organic baby food, and you can understand that that has a very high bar in terms of quality, traceability, food safety, etc. So it did come up there, and the reason why there's this export opportunity and it hasn't been capitalized on yet is because the opportunity itself is relatively new. So the viable opportunity for fresh is linked, as you rightly said earlier, to the recent availability of cold chain transport. And the viable opportunity for processed OFSP and export is linked to the recent introduction of a FDA-approved technology to produce a shelf-stable puree at a scale that doesn't require a massive industrial setup, but is actually commensurate with how these value chains are structured in a country like Kenya. So a lot of things came together really nicely there, and it was a really innovative U.S. company that has been with us on this journey that has introduced that technology, and their FDA approval basically takes care of that food safety set of requirements to exporting this product.
Caroline, could you share the name of that
company? Sure, I wasn't
and a bit
sure
more
if
about
I could,
the technology.
Yeah, so the company is called Synovatech, and they produce a technology that basically uses microwave technology to create juices and purees of agricultural products of different viscosity levels. And that juices is relatively easy, and making juices shelf-stable is not that hard, but making purees shelf-stable and sterilizing them appropriately is actually technically quite hard because the products can burn very easily with a thermal treatment. So they have come up with a really interesting approach to using a microwave technology there, and they have designed their machinery in such a way that it actually can go to again, relatively low-scale production. This is not you buy a machine and you put it at farm level and you do it at farm level. It's still a couple of tons a day, and it's still a machine that costs $100,000 to $150,000. But it's not the kind of equipment where a line of processing costs a couple of million dollars and actually needs all of the production of OFSB of an entire country to be running at full speed.
Great, thank you. Yeah, and I believe the company is also based in North Carolina mm-hmm. in the United States, and I just put up the link to their website if people are interested to look more at the technology and to explore. It's used widely in the United States already,
yeah.
And yeah, a lot of potential applications in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world. Wonderful. Looks like we have several more questions coming in. I know that Tuanda is busily answering all the technical questions. Thank him very much on sugar content, on a variety of issues. We saw, back to CJ in Rwanda, we saw there was a question on orange flush sweet potato processing and adoption in Rwanda. And though, of course, that wasn't the focus of the research for this study, CJ just wanted to give you an opportunity if you wanted to opine or discuss some opportunities in Rwanda, either on OFSB or this methodology applied to other opportunities in Rwanda.
Yeah, have a bit of a perspective on both. So I will say, I like the framing that OFSP has been successful in Rwanda, and I agree. It has been successful, and we've seen some great programs by backed by USAID and others to increase the consumption of OFSP in Rwanda. I think we've also seen OFSP attempts to make its way into processing, and we've seen some business actors that I would commend for their innovation and their willingness to step into OFSP begin to try to take on OFSP product production in Rwanda. My sense is that Rwanda has a lot of the similar characteristics that Malawi does. It's a very small population, though we are experiencing incredible economic growth and a booming middle class. We're still a very poor country. We still have a per capita GDP that's much less than half even that of Kenya. And so I think much of what we see in Rwanda is a market that looks a lot like Malawi when it comes to OFSP. And I think, has it been successful? Yes, it's great that we have some really good programs that are ensuring that children and many of the poorest districts have access to increased amounts of OFSP. And we're seeing nutritional advantages there. And I don't want to belittle that because that's incredibly important. Where we have seen attempts to commercialize OFSP in Rwanda, I think the results have been mixed, and I think we've seen perhaps some business cases in niches that are playing out. But to Carline's lens of would I put my pension money there? I don't know. I think we're seeing success, but maybe not on the commercial side. I will pivot a bit and answer the Rwanda more broadly question. And we are engaged in some work with the ISP team and USAID here, looking across a number of value chains right now. And I think there's a range of things that make a crop or a particular value chain in Rwanda particularly competitive. One would be that it is a labor-intensive thing to do that requires little land. We're a hilly country without a lot of flat farmland. And so things like cut flowers or French beans we see doing really well because they can be produced with a lot of inexpensive labor on a small plot of land. The other factor that's often very important in Rwanda is very important is things that are highly perishable. We have great infrastructure and an airline that's becoming better and better at shipping things quickly and coolly directly to Europe. And so the ability to leverage that asset can help us to play in certain value chains, however others, and I think OFSP exports would unfortunately fall into this bucket, where some of our neighbors are able to export by sea, we just would run the risk of not being competitive there. So I think I'm excited right now. I'm very excited about horticulture, and we're doing some tests into a range of other value chains, ranging from fish to macadamia nuts to chilies. that I think could be quite interesting, and stay tuned for the output of that work. But for now, very interested in horticulture, not so excited about commercialization, OFSP and Rwanda.
Great. Thank you, CJ. We'll take one more question from the very active participants. Thanks, everyone, for really participating, providing questions as well as resources. This has been a great learning process just over the last hour and a half or so. We'll go to Charles Davis asks a question on annual income analysis for farmers, how these costs were calculated and what requirements there might be. So I'll turn that over to Caroline.
Yeah, it's a great question because it actually allows us to highlight another aspect of the approach. The interesting thing of this approach is that you don't have to do that analysis. And it's a complicated and resource-intense analysis, but it's not needed. Just as when we looked at the consumer preferences and we said instead of asking consumers or doing that analysis, we just look at what's happening in the market. We did something similar when it comes to the farmer processor dynamics. There is a market clearing price. There's a price at which the farmers sell this product and a price at which the producers, therefore, or the processors buy that product. And given that farmers have alternatives in both selling this produce at the fresh market as well as over multiple seasons, obviously choosing whether or not to plant this crop, one can assume that that clearance price is a price that holds viability for the farmer. Now, if the focus of this work had been to look at maximizing economic livelihoods for farmers and choosing exactly which crop and which production method would be optimal, then obviously we would have gone into a lot of depth there. I'm not saying that this approach touches on everything that's relevant, but it actually allows you to say, we look at what's happening in the market, and particularly in a market that is actually quite nascent, like OFSP processing, where there isn't yet a dynamic of one very big buyer that the farmers have no choice but to sell to that buyer and are completely price takers. That's actually not the reality of the current markets because it's so nascent. So that's another reason to believe that market clearing price is actually not an exploitative price that represents a power disbalance. So that's an interesting aspect of this methodology. As for your question on the water use, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that, and I therefore cannot answer whether...
We did look into water use and water access.
Oh, sorry, CJ. Take it away.
And the other piece that we did look into was not necessarily the cost of producing OFSP from the perspective of, how do we get to the precise income increase for a farmer, because as Caroline pointed out, some of those costs are pretty small and don't feed into the overall story. But the one thing that was important for us to understand was, could smallholder farmers access what they needed to produce it? And so, for example, if rootstock for OFSP were to be very, very expensive, prohibitively expensive, that would be a bad sign, and that would actually be a barrier. And so we did validate that rootstock was available. It's increasingly available and available in better and better and better quantities and conditions and varietals due to the hard work of SIP. So thank you, Simone and Tawanda, who are actively continue to be answering questions, I think, because that work has made this more viable from an input perspective. And then on water, it consumes less water. I mean, pretty much what people in the three countries we looked at that are not growing OFSP, the opportunity cost for the base case is maize. And so OFSP is both more resilient and easier for a farmer from an input standpoint than maize. So it's actually a better crop all around.
Great. Thank you, CJ. Participants will notice that there's a number of questions that are brought up on the screen. So please go ahead and review the questions. We're interested in your feedback, your interests also going forward. This, of course, is not the end of this discussion, but just one point as we are working deeply either in orange flush sweet potato or other food commodities in Africa or beyond, but thinking about how we can apply this commercialization methodology to understanding, will products, or is it likely that products will scale based on private sector appetite? And can that, is that a realistic kind of development hypothesis or thesis that will be proven out in market dynamics? So quite important to this work in many countries, not just the Kenya, Malawi, South Africa, but we see many, Nigeria, Ghana, Rwanda, lots of countries have come up in the course of this conversation. So moving to our last few minutes, Caroline, I'll turn to you for a few takeaways in terms of the content. What should people, and just, you know, a few discrete points be really distilling and taking away from this presentation today?
So in terms of content, if you look across the three countries, I would say from a development perspective and accelerating that flywheel of economic growth, focus on the opportunities in Kenya. Do not focus on the opportunities in South Africa because they just don't have enough development relevance. And when engaging in Malawi, be mindful of the fact that the commercial and investment opportunities are limited and the outlook for that currently isn't all that good. You may still want to engage because it still has nutritional benefits, it still offers opportunities for farmers, but you should do so with realistic expectations as to what the private sector engagement will be.
And just to clarify, we just looked at the processing for pureed orange flesh sweet potatoes.
Yes.
So we did not take a look at the fresh market opportunities or other things.
Correct.
So just to be very clear on that.
Puree or other like chips and fries, and that's not a puree, but processing is what we looked at, yes.
And then in Kenya?
So in Kenya, yes, do like that across the three countries, focus on Kenya. Many of you have commented on the interesting opportunity that exists for export. We are very excited about that. The more domestic opportunity around bread baking is also viable. It doesn't have as much of a margin and a buffer as people have also picked up from our numbers, and does require that wheat market to come in sync a little bit more with the global trends on wheat pricing.
Great, thank you. And then, Caroline, in terms of takeaways on the methodology that we utilize, because though we studied orange flesh sweet potato deeply, really this is an approach that kind of USAID and, you know, other donors, as we see specific practices, services, technologies that can come in and really have the opportunity to be transformative in the agriculture sector, we want to know what are the opportunities for that technology or innovation to scale, and if that scaling process is likely to happen through a commercial pathway. So how can this methodology be applied, and what are some key takeaways to understand what to be looking for?
Yeah, I think there's a few key takeaways. One is make sure that you understand what will drive demand and be realistic and clear-eyed about that. I remember the first big presentation we had in this project in Malawi when we were talking about demand, and a question from the audience came, well, if we just taught people how healthy it was, wouldn't they start eating? And we had actually just finished a tea break where the deep-fried snacks had gone like crazy, and they were just completely finished within a couple of minutes. And I told the audience, I'm sure you all know that those weren't the healthiest snacks for you, but still they were finished within 2 minutes. So let's be clear-eyed and not kid ourselves about where demand is going to come from, and just telling people about how healthy a product is will actually not generate demand and will not generate an investor interest. So take a very good understanding of demand, segment it smartly the way we have done around the domestic growth, import substitution, and export opportunity, and understand that. The second key takeaway would be take an investor perspective and do so relatively ruthlessly, because, and that's not to kill all other interesting opportunities, but to make sure that you focus on the things that really can have a transformative impact. This export opportunity from Kenya exists, but it's by no means completely ready to go without any form of support, because it needs different parties to come to the table, a Sinovatec, transport, a buyer from Europe, and that will need engagement and support, which, in my opinion, should probably be spent on that rather than on many smaller opportunities for maybe like school feeding programs, if you want to look at the commercial opportunity and not just the nutritional benefits. So make sure that you take an investor-led approach and do so relatively ruthlessly to help yourself prioritize. And then the last, I would say, is those two will help you in your analysis, focus on the things you truly need to understand so that you don't have to spend time on things that you don't, for this effort, need to understand. So to the consumer preferences, the formal pricing, the things that we spoke about, you can use a lot of the what's actually happening in the market as pointers for that reality and the reality that investors will take as cues.
Great. Thank you so much, Caroline. Well, we're wrapping up this webinar today. I wanted to thank again CJ Fonzi and Kigali Rwanda. Thank you for joining, CJ. Thanking Caroline Nauman in Washington, D.C. with us. Also thanking Tawanda for being very active in the chat box and providing lots of critical technical answers throughout the webinar. And then finally, thank you to everyone at AgriLinks for facilitating and making this learning community possible. And with that, we'll close the webinar today. Thanks for all the participation.